A small warning about our next story. It discusses domestic violence and suicide. Hannah Baxter and her three children have died in Brisbane after Hannah's estranged husband, Rowan Baxter, allegedly doused the car in petrol. He later died from self-inflicted stab wounds. Half of all female homicide victims over the age of 18 in New Zealand are killed by a partner or an ex-partner. And every time we hear a story like this, it shocks us and the call goes out for something to change. But does anything change? And what has been tried in the past? I'm joined now by the program leader of the Postgraduate Violence and Trauma Program at AUT and founder of the Man Alive counselling organisation, Warwick Pudney. Hi, Warwick.
Kia ora, Jesse.
Kia ora. What was your initial reaction when you heard this story?
Shock, and it always shocks me, this sort of thing, and I do deal quite a bit with stories like this, but I think it's avoidable, and I'm happy to talk about some of that.
Yeah. Were there aspects of what we know about this case that rang a bell for you that are repeated in other cases and sort of form a pattern?
I think one of the problems we're dealing with here is the masculinity that our boys are brought up in. And I know there's quite a bit of work being done in this area now and getting people to think much more carefully about this. But it's the sort of masculinity that he's experienced is quite crippling. It says, you know, you play for a team called the Warriors and you have to win, and you're the ultimate male machine, and vulnerability really isn't in the question. And I think sports teams, everybody, family courts, should be thinking about male vulnerability a whole lot more, and allowing men to think about male vulnerability, so that they can talk about stuff. And that sort of energy, sort of crazy energy that's been reported is avoidable if there's early interventions.
I should point out that Warwick Pudney was a contracted player for the NRL, though he never took the field for the Warriors, but no doubt plenty of that sort of culture that you were talking about as he came up through age group rugby league. People will know what you're referring to, of course. And I suppose it will be distasteful for some people that we're talking about the guy here, the alleged perpetrator, but we're sort of looking for solutions, aren't we? So what can be done in society and specifically with individuals so that things like this don't happen in the future? What are our best ideas, Warwick?
Well, for a start, I think there's a gender bias around this. The very fact that we're talking about it and it concerns me. One of my students is doing some research into men who've suffered in family violence. And the story that's coming back on this is the widespread assumption that it actually wasn't the woman that was violent, it was the man. Now, I'm not in any sort of denial here of male family violence. What I'm saying is it is possible for men to be suffering and to have great vulnerability. So our media and our police particularly have been named in this ongoing research as having attitudes that inflate this, and men report going to the police and not being believed when they report things like this. So the point I'm making here is we need to be able to listen to men's stories, and men need to be able to be confident to tell them. So what I'm interested in is the dad who listens to his son when his three-year-old falls over, scrapes his knee, and is crying. And who does he go to? Well, he needs to be able to go to dad as much as mum. So we need those dads to be responsive to that wee lad and say, hey there, fella, that must be really hurting. Come on, come with me, we'll go and put a plaster on it or something like that. And in that act, males learn that you can go to other men with your vulnerability. It's sad to me that there was a men's line operating out of the Lifeline organisation for about 10 years until it fell over due to lack of funding. The responsibility, if we're looking for preventing this happening again, is to provide those places where men can go and be believed and speak of their vulnerability and the problems that they're having. I do note on the Herald report that somebody had offered him, another man had offered him some support verbally as a result of him disclosing, I guess, what was going on. But clearly he needed heaps more. And the report seems to suggest that he was in a very unstable mental condition. That's not much in the way of condolence to the people who have suffered and the people who have died.
No, it can sound a bit like making an excuse for him too, respectfully. I mean, there are people who come up through that environment we're talking about, that ultra-masculine environment. There are people who are raised with dads who don't pay much attention when they're vulnerable and they don't turn into violent perpetrators of domestic violence. But when it does go wrong, as it seems to have here, why does it go wrong? Is it, in your view, because of the coping skills a man develops when he doesn't have an outlet, someone to talk to, someone to display vulnerability to?
Well, I'd suggest that he wasn't in a habit of talking about stuff. It's almost inevitable in that particular role is in, and you've made that point. But I'm also, say, thinking of one of my students is doing a study around firemen and the rising rate of self-harm and suicide through our firemen particularly. And that's the same problem. You know, these are these brave men who handle hoses on a calendar, and they look strong and handsome. And so all those quite crippling assumptions and projections are taken on, and they're quite inhibiting of him saying, gee, I don't know if I want to go to this next event. It's a hanging, a cut down or something like that, because it's too close to home. So we need to be creating these possibilities for men talking about, and we also need people trained to listen to men. Many counsellors carry the sort of assumptions that we're talking about. We need to be acquainted with the male grief process, which is going to be different from women, because women get much more permission to express that grief. What was the question there, Jesse?
Well, I'm just so aware that we, in trying to explain and unpick what's gone wrong, it can have the impression of trying to excuse it. So I want to make it really clear that we're not doing that. Maybe just before we finish, a bit of a chat about these key moments, the most dangerous time for what is largely women and children, which seems to be after a traumatic event of some kind, like a breakup. How do we... What can we do to make those most dangerous times less dangerous?
Well, we need to be doing good assessments on when a person might be dangerous. And in that, ourselves and services taking some actions to just test whether or not they are needed and how desperate this person is. And then we need to have a specific training on how to deal with them. So there's this thing around prediction and appropriate intervention at the right time. The biggest problem in this whole thing around men's distress and suicides and harm of other people is isolation. We really need guys out there talking to guys and breaking that down. And we are making progress. I'm really pleased when I hear men approaching other men, even men who had poor fathering, because I do think poor fathering good fathering is a key factor in this. And that allows that to happen. And we could ask the question, why don't women do these things? And there we will get some of those answers. Women are simply not so isolated and do have services. And we don't train them to harm other people. Men are continually put in that protector role.
Warwick Pudney, founder of the Man Alive Counselling Organisation and program leader of the Postgraduate Violence and Trauma Program at AUT, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jesse.